Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, hello. Dimes Fabric. Ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the backyard. This is Margaret Marshall, your host, and I want to welcome you this evening as we start our program. And I see we have callers on the board already, and I want to welcome the callers on the board as well as those listening online, and continue to apologize for not being able to interact with the callers online, as I'm not that technically skilled yet, and I'm still hoping to get an assistant to operate that end for me very shortly. But those listening online, if you want to join the Labrish, please dial in at 718-766-4558. And this evening, I am a little sad, a lot sad, because for those of you who are on my mailing list, I sent out an email last night stating that Professor Rex Nettleford had passed away. And we had him here in the backyard as late as September of last year. And I was very fortunate to have him as a guest because he was attending a fundraiser here in Atlanta for one of his passions. If all the people in the diaspora that know of him knows how passionate he was about learning, education, and the arts. So I'm sure that not only people in Jamaica and the Caribbean, but all over the world will be mourning his passing, and especially people in the artistic field in Jamaica and the rest of the Caribbean. I actually have two recordings of that we made while he was here in Atlanta. So my condolences goes out to his circle of friends and his family. I know that he buried his mother recently when he was up here in September. So may his soul rest in peace. And next week, I am hoping to put together a memorial show for him where I'm hoping to be able to interview some of the people that might have known him better than I did. But he was almost larger than life. And if you have a chance, please listen to the segment that he did with us here in the backyard. And the date on that is September 13th of last year. So we know that we all have to go, but it's always just, you know, so painful when someone that we treasure make their transition. But, you know, thank God he did not suffer. And I know that he lived his passion and a very full life. And we were blessed. And I know I feel blessed to have shared some time on the planet with him. So with that said, I want to invite members on the board, callers on the board, to put your hand up. I always like to remind everybody, first of all, you're listening to Backyard Labrish on Blog Talk Radio. We're here each week at 8 o'clock on a Wednesday. And the whole premise behind Backyard Labrish is to celebrate, enlighten, and preserve the rich culture of Jamaica, and especially the Jamaica that the older members of the diaspora know before pre-independence. Because a lot of us have, you know, traveled away from the island before it became independent, and but we still have the love and will always love our roots and our country. And I will always be celebrating the wonderful things and the wonderful people and the people that made it wonderful. And Professor Nettleford was certainly one of them. And next week we'll be going into some details of his work and his contribution to our culture that I'm sure will live on for many, many generations. So with that said, again, welcome to all the callers on the board from 673-516-718 and those listening online. And please remember that I'm here by myself, sitting in my easy chair, trying to sip on my coffee and think of how blessed we were to have the professor here in our backyard. And that's why I really enjoy this platform, and I'm hoping that more people, more of the, especially the seniors, will, you know, make friends with it and not be scared of it. Because just think that the conversation we had with the professor in September is still available, will be available, I think, forever. No one can destroy cyberspace, I don't think. But long after I'm gone, the next generation, hopefully some of my grandchildren and or their children, will be able to get a glimpse of what we were like, or at least get a feeling just from listening to our voices of, you know, just our personalities, the facts that we're sharing about the period we lived in, which I call it really leaving a living, live legacy. Because, you know, things can be destroyed by fire or earthquakes or just destruction. I'm sure the victims and the survivors in Haiti who can try to sort out anything, I don't even know if that's possible with all the destruction, but it's so wonderful to just be able to retrieve something that you treasure, even if it's just one item that you can hold on to from your past. And so that's what we're trying to do here in the backyard with the Labrish, is to preserve some of our memories for the generations to come. So with that said, tonight we're supposed to be, first of all, we're starting History Month. It's History Month, it's Black History Month here in the United States, and there's so much history to be discussed and celebrated, and we too have a lot of history coming from Jamaica. So tonight, because we are still extending hope and our prayers and our contributions to the people of Haiti, I am going to be talking about our period of earthquakes. And for the people who are on my mailing list or on the circulation that's going around of information about Jamaica, there was recently an email that I got about a scientist, current scientist, who had actually predicted that there was going to be some movements at that part of the world, you know, by their findings. And it's interesting to see, if you see the chart and the fault line, you will see that it ran directly from Port-au-Prince to Kingston. So it's not surprising that what we're going to discuss tonight in a little more details is the devastation of Kingston in 1907. And I see that I have a raised hand on 416-653. So because this is a collaboration, that's what we do. I'm going to open up the mic to my guests so that they can join me here in the backyard. And the mic is open. Good evening. This is Margaret in Backyard Labrish. Who do I have here?
Good evening, Margaret. This is Toronto calling. Phyllis.
Hi, Phyllis. How nice to hear you. The keeper of the Anansi stories.
That's right.
Yes.
I'm calling to say Happy New Year. I should have been.
Well, thank you so much.
But better late than never.
Right.
And wish you all the very best for 2010. And to share this Ashanti proverb with you. Do not
Wonderful. With me and the rest of the world.
The rest.
Yes.
Do not follow the path. Go where there is no path and begin the trail. So I want to thank you for going where there is no path and beginning this trail that we have talk blog that we can call in and speak to each other. So thank you for that.
Oh, I appreciate that so much. And thank you for all your contribution to the backyard. And
it's
I want to let you know that, you know, the show that we did together about the work you have done and are doing has been downloaded many, many, many times. I'll give you the figures when we talk. Again, I've lost count. But because of the support that the program have had from, you know, various people who are just as passionate as I am about our culture, they're just not as, you know, I suppose, gusty as I am to really just branch out and do something like this as old as I am. Anyway, we are over 6,600 downloads.
Wonderful.
And that is when people miss listening to the show, you know, not all together at one time,
but since
it has been broadcast.
Mm-hmm.
Because
that's
people
wonderful.
Go back, you know, at their leisure and listen to a particular show or, you know, a number of shows as they work on their computers, I guess.
Yes.
But I thank you so much for calling in. And tonight, you know, we are sort of somber because, as you know, the Professor Nettleford has left us.
And Albert Huey, so that's two.
Yes, yes. And but, you know, these people just leave so much rich history and that we can continue to celebrate and enlighten and hopefully preserve.
Well, as I said to a friend, I will not mourn for either Albert Huey, who has left an entire body of painting and has been celebrated all over the world as one of Jamaica's leading painters, nor will I mourn for all that Rex Nettleford did for Jamaica, many, many of the young people that he gave an opportunity to excel in this area. Rather, I will honor all that they have done in remembering that if they had not lived, those would have been two areas that would not have been fulfilled.
Right.
For the young people who came after. And all those people that came after, in Albert Huey's case, you have people like Christopher Gonzalez, a whole number of painters that I can't think of at the moment, who followed in his footsteps. Almost all of the younger painters who are now, say, in their late 40s or so.
Right, young ones.
The young ones.
Yes. Well, I thank you for bringing that to my attention because I didn't even, I was up till late last night trying to put together, you know, the what happened with Professor Netherford. And I did not really go online. When did he pass?
I think he passed on Monday the 1st.
Oh, I see. I was not aware of that. So I appreciate you bringing that to our attention.
Well, he has certainly, he taught for many years in Jamaica. His works, the paintings are at Devon House. I think I've heard that there's an entire area there at Devon House for his paintings that, you know, people can go and view them. And
right, right.
All over the world, really. Mm-hmm. He is exhibited here in Canada, and a book was published about 3 years ago on his contributions to the whole art scene, because Mrs. Manley, the former Norman, I'm speaking of, Norman Manley's
okay,
wife,
uh-huh.
Edna.
Edna, mm-hmm.
Yeah, was a real mover and shaker in the area of promoting that particular type of art, the painters and the sculptors, because she herself...
She was a sculptor, yes, yes.
And it is just amazing. I'm very pleased to have a copy of the book. I can't think of the title at the moment, but it's a wonderful, some wonderful reproductions of his work in that book.
Oh,
so
great.
Buried, I think it's he'll be buried on Monday the 8th.
Where did he reside?
These last few years, in his 80s, he was in Baltimore, where his daughter is.
Oh, I see.
His wife, Phyllis Huey, and Huey, both, they moved between Jamaica and Baltimore because he said he could never paint anywhere but in Jamaica.
Wow.
The inspiration was there, so that is the only place that he could paint in.
But he got you right. The energy, I suppose, supported him there.
Yes.
I know that you know that is important to you because you're also an artist. So I want to make the listeners that might not be familiar with your work know. Would you just give us a little information about your art of the enameling?
Well, enameling is a process of fusing pulverized glass to a metal. We usually use copper because it's less expensive than gold and silver. And it's fired in a kiln that's approximately 1,500 degrees Fahrenheit.
Wow. And,
I am the founder of the Canadian Enameling Association, which I founded in 1988. Now
wow.
We have a new name. It's called Enamel Art Canada, EMA Canada, to incorporate the French because many things got changed over when they decided that we must honor the twinned nature of this.
Right, right.
And I've done a lot of work. At present, my work here is at the Guild, which is the Guild shop is the place where most artists who have arrived at a certain level would put their art. And I've taught it for many years, and I won an award for art in public places 1 year here. And it's a large 18-foot work that is housed at the Maria A. Shuka Library here in Toronto. So I've done it for a very, very long time along with the storytelling, and I continue to do it because I love it.
Right, right. And I was inspired when we did the show in the fact that you made your storytelling you integrated your storytelling with your art.
Yes. Yes.
Because your murals tell a story.
Well, that piece that is in that library, it really honors two things that are important to me. Honors one, Garrett A. Morgan, the African-American who invented the traffic signals that are used all over the world. And it honors the rise of women always, because where there is an opportunity for women to advance, invariably we have better things happening. We know of this brilliant man from Bangladesh who started the microbanking.
Yes, yes.
He gave a loan to women first because he said when the women, the wife, looks after the family.
Family, mm-hmm.
Yes. Then you have changes, and it's amazing. Almost 70% of the people moved up from abject poverty into being able to sustain themselves. So unlike the terrible IMF,
the
vampire that feeds on the poor.
Right, right.
So you meet a man like that who has a vision to help the poor to improve. And as we look on at Haiti now, trying to extricate themselves from all this mess, there are many movements that are going on asking to have the debt just wiped off the slate.
Right.
So that anything that they receive from now will be in the form of grants so that they can build their country back instead of all the money going to repaying this unfair debt, which shouldn't have been in the first place.
Right.
Or shouldn't have been. And so I'm writing a new work at the moment to present on the 26th of February about Haiti, because it is just wrong. It's immoral. And I keep telling people about the movie Life and Debt, D-E-B-T. And every Jamaican should see it, because it really shows you that the IMF treats these countries, including Jamaica, just in the same way as people who have a credit card debt that they don't pay back. These immediately, if they just pay a small portion, then it keeps revolving, and the $60 pair of shoes that they bought on sale, at the end of 3 years, it might be $600 for that pair of shoes.
Right.
But it's not just that one part that makes the thing shameful. It is that they say take down the trade barriers, and tiny places like Jamaica must have their milk competing with the mighty America, for example. And then we have, in that movie, when you see the farmers, because I don't know anything about farming, but there's a farmer saying that you have to milk a cow twice a day. So when they say they're not buying the milk in January until October, every day you just have to milk the cow, and there's a
throw it away.
Picture. They just have to throw it away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If you get that movie and you see that milk just running out on the ground, your heart hurts you.
Right, right.
And so that is what happens. Then you have the free zones, where in the movie you see the free zones. They build these things, their factories, but they don't pay any taxes or anything to Jamaica, so that if they were paying any taxes, then that would be money that Jamaica could be using. And I have to keep explaining it over and over, because when people say to me, what are the politicians doing with the money? I said, what money? So this is what has happened to Haiti. At one time, Haiti was one of the richest countries. But then France demanded all this payment from them. And so they have never been able to extricate themselves from it. They defeated, the Africans defeated the French legitimately in battle. And then they sent back, Napoleon thought, I am going to capture Haiti again. And he sent ships and more soldiers and Leclerc. They found a way to get Toussaint Louverture onto a ship, tricked him and took him away to France, to a dungeon. And then after this big battle again, where they said they were going to reinstitute slavery, the slaves who had become complacent, when they realized what was coming, they all joined together with the so-called mulattoes, and they defeated them. And into Haiti came a wonderful leader, Christophe, who rebuilt that country. It became a shining jewel. Then we begin all over again, France demanding all these sums of money. And this is the mistake they made, thinking honor would be the coin, but it wasn't. And this is the debt that has been crippling them for forever, this vast sum of money. And as far as I'm concerned, the people who have started this movement saying, we must wipe this off the slate and allow Haiti to start again, because in my book, everywhere that people have been enslaved, instead of wasting time talking about repatriation, they should say in the year 2012, for example, or 2011, we start on a clean slate, because they've already gotten sums of money out of these tiny places that just, it is immeasurable, the amount of money they have had. So the thing that should be done is that they should wipe away these debts and start anew. Because to think of children making cookies out of dirt, and then the things that they've done, they went into Haiti and they killed off all the native pigs that had developed and could live in the environment, brought in some liquor, here's a Jamaican word, fenke fenke pig from America. The pigs just died off, so there they were starving even more. The rice. It's just wrong. It's immoral. It's wrong and it is immoral. It is wrong for France to be taking money from these starving people. It's just wrong.
Well, tonight what we plan to do is, you know, I personally firmly believe that while there is life, there is hope.
Yes.
And for the survivors, you know, we just have to hold hope out and support, you know, anything mentally and physically and whatever we can do to support hope.
Yes.
And one of the things I thought I would do is to not necessarily make a comparison, but just in the line of while there's life, there's hope. You know that Jamaica itself had several earthquakes in different parts and different severities. Last week we did the destruction of Port Royal in 1692.
Yes.
And talk about similar human behaviors that is cropping up now, you know, because we're all human, whether we're rich or poor or black or white. But it was interesting to find in last week's documentation that I researched that, you know, during that time it was mostly the pirates and the religious people that trying to convert them, or, you know, there weren't any black people there then.
Mm-hmm.
But when, after everything was torn up, I mean, people were looting.
Yes.
They were looting, they were killing one another. I read a story where one man, one eyewitness said, this man shot the other man just to take his things away, whatever things he had at the time, because he wanted it. So, you know, there are similarities in how people behave in the face of disaster. And a lot of times it has nothing to do with, you know, their circumstances, whether they're black or white or rich or poor. So I thought tonight that I would give the listeners and people in the diaspora some stories that have been documented by the Gleaner Company. It has a beautiful segment called Pieces of the Past,
mm-hmm.
where they have information, you know, on different happenings and whatever, I think mostly from documentation from the Gleaner Company itself. And there is a wonderful researcher who's living in Jamaica, Dr. Joy Lumsden, who has been piecing together from different sources, like, you know, a death certificate or a letter from somebody, you know, in 18 something, or and she's just piecing people's lives together and how they connected to some to the tragedy, some to different events that has some historical significance. So what I wanted to do tonight was to take a little, and we're into the history month, of course, to take a little look back in the history of Kingston, mostly because, you know, it is, as I mentioned before, I don't know if you heard, Phyllis, where I said a scientist predicted that there would be some, you know, movement along the fault line, which runs actually from Port-au-Prince directly to Kingston.
Yes.
But it's interesting to find out that after Port Royal, you know, it was after Port Royal was the big thing in 1692. But there's a documentation here that says it can be said that the city of Kingston was founded first out of disaster and then out of trickery. In 1692, when a massive earthquake destroyed Port Royal, which was long the seat of the island's trade and a large residential area, the land across the harbor known as the Ligonie Plains, we know that, right?
Yeah.
After the giant Ligonie, began to look more attractive. After witnessing the massive destruction and sinking of Port Royal, the desire to rebuild that town was lukewarm at best. At the time of the Port Royal earthquake, there were probably only 8 or 9 houses on some 530 acres of Ligonie Plain, all related to Colonel Samuel Barry's hog pen, or hog crawl, as it was more commonly known. Now, sometime in the early 1660s, Barry sold the land to William Beeston so that in June of 1692, when a new town was needed to provide homes for former Port Royal residents, Nicholas Laws acted on Beeston's behalf, whoever he was, and sold 200 of the 530 acres to the Jamaican Council, the island's governing body. The total cost was £1,000. When Beeston returned to Jamaica as lieutenant governor in 1693, a post he would hold until 1700, he declared the sale of his land legal and, illegal and repossessed the property, which by that time consisted of some 800 lots, most 150 feet long and 50 feet wide. Beeston resold the lots at a large profit, well aware that future profit was in store as he owned the 330 acres surrounding the new town. So all of this went on after the earthquake in Port Royal. Now, soon after, the Jamaican Council instructed an English surveyor to draw up a plan for this new town on the southeast section of the island. The town, as originally drawn by this John Goffey, was eventually laid out by an engineer named Lilly, and was chessboard-like, running 1 mile in length from north to south. That's when you came into Port Royal Street to the north. And so all of those streets that we knew as we were growing up went back from 16-something. I found that very, very interesting.
That is very interesting.
Isn't that something?
Yeah. And as I say, with these years and years ago, Christopher Wren, when London burned down, he could rebuild it as the architect, as a better place. So maybe out of all of this horror will come something that is better. Just
right, exactly what was my, my thought, that in the Kingston we knew when we were growing up showed absolutely no evidence of all of this devastation, you know, that took part in 1907, or what it was even before 1907, because this was before everything was just more or less trash and mush.
Yes,
because Port Royal was then the big deal.
Yes.
So you know, this was the plan to now move all of this activity from Port Royal to Kingston. As a matter of fact, the original name was King's, K-I-N-G, apostrophe S, town.
Mm-hmm.
You know, two separate words.
Two separate words.
Mm-hmm. Now, around parade, and it was drawn up, you know, by this architect person. Now, around parade, in addition to the military camp, there was a military camp downtown someplace there, was the parish church and later a playhouse, the Theatre Royal. The commercial buildings and the courthouse were found closer to the sea. Now, wealthier residents favored the eastern section, while poorer residents made do with the west, many living on land owned by the merchants John Hanna and William Ray, which were close to swamps. One of the island's first burial grounds, Maypen Cemetery, lies near this area. Now, Hanna Town would become one of St. Andrew's first residential settlements. Many regarded Kingston as having been well laid out with wide streets of varying widths. And then they have a map showing it. Now, Kingston was made a parish in 1713. It had a natural harbor, massive defenses in its ring fort, you know, to ward off the enemy, I suppose, fertile soil, and access to water supply. By the mid-1700s, Kingston had grown from a seaside town with 6 miles of waterfront to a city which was awash in houses, stores, and wharfs. Clearly, the island's commercial capital. It was said to be strange to see less than 200 vessels in the bay before the town had even given time. In 1774, the Chamber of Commerce, one of the first in the New World, was formed. By the end of the 18th century, Kingston's population reached 25,000. Beg your pardon?
Can you see then if we were free of this horrible debt that we don't know how the country would evolve, but there is no doubt that this destruction of the farms and the native people's way of living has helped to create more crime, more problems, more challenges. And Mahatma Gandhi says the rich must live more simply so that the poor can simply live. And this is what is happening in both of these countries. As I say good night to you, that somebody else can get on the line. I don't want to be monopolizing everything.
Oh, okay. Well, it was a pleasure having you, and thanks for your input.
I really
and we hope you'll continue to spread the word of the backyards celebration and enlightenment and preservation of our culture. And I really appreciate you being part of it.
I needed to say to you all the best. And if you ever feel to go to the website is theguildshop.ca.
Okay, and I invite my listeners to go, and your art is displayed there?
Yes.
You can see the art on the website.
TheGuildShop.ca. One word.
Okay. Very good. Thank you so much.
All the very best. I'm going to go on listening anyhow.
All right. And stay warm.
I will.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Margaret. Thank you.
All right. On behalf of our listeners, I thank you. Good night. And I want to continue to welcome all the listeners on the board and to invite you, really, to interact whenever you wish. This is what a Labrish is all about. And tonight, for those who might come by later, we are really here tonight to just talk, discuss some of the things that may be similar in some ways to what's happening in Haiti now, with the hope that the survivors and their families that might be here or scattered all over the world will hold on to something that, you know, if they have people alive, and I know there are a lot of people alive, even those that were dug out, you know, it wasn't their time to go, and they're still on the planet, and they have difficult days ahead, but I know that while there is life, there is hope. So we're going to talk about how especially Jamaica and Kingston came back from a terrible disaster. It might not have been on the same scale in terms of numbers, but because there were not as many people living there on the island at the time, you know, if you take that into consideration, it would be of similar, you know, amounts of and the tragic things were different in those days, because even getting help from one place to another was not as quick and sophisticated as it is now. So again, I want to remind the listeners that you're listening to Backyard Labrish Blog Talk on Blog Talk Radio, and we're here once a week on a Wednesday just to do just that, to labrish. And tonight we're labrishing about the history of earthquakes in Jamaica. And I don't know if there are any listeners on the board that's as old as I am, but I'm a senior. And although I do not see any documentation on, like, in the 30s and 40s, and 50s when I grew up, not much except for 1957. But I remember as a child in school and in my house having tremors, and it was earthquakes. I mean, houses didn't fall down, but not one time or twice. But I remember them happening quite often. And at first I was wondering if it was all in my head, and then I talked to a couple of my girlfriends, and they tell me, yes, they don't remember. They remember. Now, I downloaded something from, I think it was the Jamaica Pieces of the Past, and it listed major, well, they're talking about major earthquakes here, I suppose. Tremors are not considered really an earthquake. But the major earthquakes listed on the Pieces of the Past website, which is to be found at the Jamaica Gleaner Company, it says June 7th in 1692, Port Royal was destroyed. We discussed that last week. Then on August 28th, 1912, there was an earthquake. On August 28th, 1712. On August 28th, 1722, Savlamar and Kingston had a problem and was destroyed, it said, had some places destroyed. In October 20th of 1744, they had damages again in Port Royal, I suppose what was left of it. In November 11th, 1812, but in January 14th, 1907, was a major earthquake, which really is the one that we're discussing tonight, that really destroyed Kingston. Not only did it destroy it by earthquake, but they had a fire that burned for days. And on March 1st, 1957, and I remember this one distinctly, there was a earthquake of the eight points on the Richter scale, with the epicenter being in Hanover. And I remember that one distinctly. As a matter of fact, a girlfriend of mine who lived on down the block from me in Franklintown says she remembers running out in the street because, you know, it was so frightening. And last week, some of our listeners talked about, you know, coming home from church. Some were home and went under the table. But even before that, I remember tremors as a little girl growing up, and they were very frightening. And I'm saying that to say, just imagine the children that lived through this. You know, can you imagine the state of mind that they're in? Because even now I can think back when as a child I hear the dishes in the china cabinet hitting together and making that noise. And believe me, I can hear the noise now because it was very, very frightening to me. So I really, really pray every night for the children that they would, you know, that they're able to have some peace of mind and get some sleep somehow, because it's that a trauma like that for children. And there seem to have been a lot of children who survived. You know, a lot of them are going through other situations now, which we're really not discussing tonight. But as I say, you know, let's keep the people there and their families in our thoughts, in our prayers, but also knowing that we can, that there's hope. There is hope. So now I wanted to, if any of the listeners online want to join the Labrish, please hit one on your telephone, and I'll see that you're holding up your hand like you used to be in school in the old days. And also the listeners online, if you would call in at 718-766-4558 to join the Labrish. So I want to go back a little bit to telling you about Kingston, and then we have a little time to talk about what actually took place in 1907. So in the early 1800s, Kingston was regarded as the great port of the Caribbean, just as its predecessors, Port Royal, had been a century earlier. In 1802, during the reign of King George, Kingston was granted a charter as a corporation, winning original recognition as a city in that year, which is, we're talking about 1802. Now, there was a writing, the story of Tom Cringle, which was written in about that time. The early 19th century, Kingston noted in his log, everything appeared to be thriving. This is from a writer. The hot, sandy streets were crowded with drays conveying goods from the wharves to the store. That was the mode of transportation in those days. The appearance of the town itself was novel and pleasing. The houses, chiefly of two stories, looked as if they had been built of cards, most of them being surrounded by a plaza gaily painted in green and white, the streets unpaved and more looking like a dry river course than thoroughfares. And this is how it was described in this book that was written in about that century. The book actually was published in 1993, page 69, it says. You can find the documentation on that. But in 1834, the year that marked the abolition of the slavery on the island, that was published in the Gleaner, which had become one of Jamaica's main newspapers and certainly the oldest one still in print. It began, I didn't even know that the Gleaner Company was actually started in 1834. Huh. And it began in Kingston. By mid-century, there were 24 newspapers. The Jamaica Gleaner was the first, and this is one that is still in print now. But during that time, there were 24 newspapers in print in Jamaica. 19 were published in Kingston. Michael College was started on Hanover Street in 1836, and St. George's College at Winchester Park in 1850. Now, following the full emancipation of slavery, of the slaves in 1838, more and more schools and hospitals began to be built all over the island. So that I found very interesting as part of my presentation for History Month. And again, I'm looking for a raised hand from my listeners. So now I want to talk about what happened in 1907. And this is from part of Dr. Joy Lumsden's collection of information from eyewitnesses. And this is from one writer. I was seated at a little table. Every window and door of the room was wide open. The heat was obsessive. Picture a cloudless sky at a temperature of 92 or 95 degrees Fahrenheit in the shade. Relieved about midday, the temperature they're talking about, relieved about midday by a cooling breeze that increased in power until about 3:30 o'clock, when it had attained the violence almost of a gale. They're talking about the wind. Doors were repeatedly banging. Blinds on every window were forever waving in the wind. At each violent gust, they would snap like the crack of a whip. Lace curtains breaking loose from the lower fastenings were streaming continuously on the breeze. On the windward side, they were often level with the ceiling itself. They're talking about the curtains going up with the ceiling. This is someone sitting someplace watching this. The strong breeze began to lose force until at about 3:30, it had faded into nothingness. For 2 minutes, there was not a breath of wind, no door banged, no blinds moved, curtains fell back to their places, not a sigh lifted, a leaf on a bough. Silence. Nature had seemingly withdrawn for her afternoon siesta. And then, without murmur or warning, from the blue mountains beyond, or the still bluer heavens above, or the ground beneath our feet, there steals drawn under us some unimaginable monster, before whom the very earth reels and groans in violent agony and despair. The heightening roar is of eternal memory. It was as though some vast herd of tigers, with warm blood already on their tongues, had been robbed of their prey. It was hell. And that apparently was written by a very poetic person who lived through that tremor. Now, the town of Kingston, this is from another writer, the town of Kingston lay flat and from the sea gave the appearance of a large tract of wasteland on which heaps of rubbish were burning. And this is an eyewitness after the earthquake really tore everything up and the fire started. The smothering molds and the dense cloud of smoke which lay all over the ruined town made a gloomy contrast to the bright sunshine and delightful coloring so common to these islands. And this was someone writing who was on a ship that happened to be in this wonderful harbor. And, you know, I didn't know Kingston when I was growing up as being a big harbor. I remember that boats used to come in, and I remember how, I think there were not tourist boats. I don't remember them. And if any of the listeners on the board can correct me about this, because I remember there was a market right downtown, right on the water. And the ships used to come in there, because at that time Tower Isle Hotel was right across on one side, and there was this big market. I don't remember the name of the market, but it was like a craft market at the time. And I remember it had a gazebo someplace down there, and the military band always played. But I remember ships being there. And they used to throw money overboard, and the children that were usually at the wharf would jump in to try and retrieve the money. And I see that I have 718379 who wants to join the Labrish and perhaps remember some of these things that we knew when we were growing up. So I'm going to be opening up the mic in a minute. Good evening. Welcome to the backyard. This is Matt.
This is Lay from the Bronx. I just wondered if you meant Tower Isle and not Myrtle Bank Hotel.
Right, you are so right. Tower Isle Hotel. Myrtle Bank is on the North Coast, right? Or was on the North Coast.
Yeah, and just as you're on the harbor in Kingston, I remember from my geography class, had one of the three natural harbors in the world.
Really?
And don't ask me to tell you the other two. I have a senior moment. I'm also a senior, probably older than you.
Oh, well, welcome to the senior club.
Anyway,
and I wonder if there are any juniors on the board that would like to help us out.
Yeah.
There are quite a few people on the board, but they, as usual, they like to remain silent, and we really appreciate everyone that call in. And hang with us here in the backyard. And we do hope that you're enjoying our little casual Labrish. I always tell people that, you know, I'm not trained for this platform. I just had a passion of starting this and, you know, wanting to celebrate and learn more. I'm learning so much just from doing the research. And a lot of times this information is, some of it was written in old English, you know, how they used to talk in those days. It's funny how, you know, the English, the spoken word, seemed to change over a period of time, because some of this from the eyewitness reports were actually written in old English. And I find as I read them that people were seem to be a lot more lavish with their words, and, you know, words were used differently then. And I just find it very fascinating. I don't know if any of the other, and sometimes I have difficulty reading it, which is the same way I have difficulty sometimes reading the new patois, because, you know, it's Louise Bennett's patois I find easier to read, I suppose, because I knew it as a child or a young person. But the present-day patois, reading it, I understand it when it's spoken, but reading it is a little I find a little challenging.
And just to go back a little bit on your comment about the ships, the ships that would come into the harbor would be cargo ships primarily.
Oh.
You know, and they would be bringing in all different kinds of produce, lumber, this, that, and the other. Petrol, too, oil for the country.
Right. Now, are you talking about during our time or before?
No, even before. I mean, it was, since it was such an important port and a harbor, it would be a transportation hub, so to speak, for
different
countries coming in and exchanging cargo and refueling, etc.
Well, here is somebody else's report. Monday, January 14th, 1907, 3:30 p.m. I mean, they were very precise with the time. It was a regular day, sunny and hot, with a cloudless sky and what was said to be a faint breeze. At 3:32 p.m., the city of Kingston was busy enough. All was alive and well. Suddenly, there came the sound of a rushing mighty wind, followed by the sound of a train roaring in a tunnel and the violent shaking of the earth, so that men and buildings were tossed about like puppets. Screams split the air. Within 10 to 20 seconds, a town of 46,000 had been rendered immobile. Hundreds lay dead or dying, buried beneath mounds of rubble and dust. By 3:33 p.m., three shocks had been felt, and every building in Kingston sustained some damage. Many in the lower part of the city were totally destroyed. Accounts of this catastrophic event, was written up by Ralph Hall Crane and published in 1908. It reported that solid brick walls bulging and collapsing, carriages being lifted and flung through the air, telephone poles swaying like leaves in the wind, and great structures, whether made of iron, wood, or stone, crumbling. People were simply picked up and tossed while struggling to maintain their balance. More often than not, they ended up resembling falling pawns in an overturned chess game. You see how poetic they are even in their description? That is a sidebar, Leigh.
That's good writing.
Yes, this is what I mean. Very good writing. And not only that, they... please forgive me. Let me get rid of this thing. Just a minute, please. Yes, they were, in their description of everything, you know, it was passionate and personal and poetic. The writing, really.
Well, don't forget, most of the information that we got then was in writing. We didn't have television and radios.
Mm-hmm.
So it was fortunate that people could write so well.
Right. Now, it says here, what many thought were heaps of dust were actually people trying to move in a city that had suddenly become foreign. Within 20 minutes, fire blazed through the streets of Kingston and lasted for up to 4 days. In many cases, finishing off what the earthquake had started. It was also not long before rampant looting broke out and armed guards had to be posted throughout the city. At the public hospital, there was no way to cope with the numbers of wounded. At 3:30 on that fateful day, there were some 200 patients in hospital, and by 5 p.m., that number had risen to 800. According to W. Ralph Hall Crane, who observed much of the devastation from the port in Kingston, the ship on which he had sailed to the West Indies with numerous English businessmen, planters, and parliamentarians. The sky was a brilliant constellation of glorious lights, the waters over which we passed, dark and awesome, rendered all the more forbearing by the human tragedy, for which I must shut my eyes, floating idly on its surface for a ruined city. Days later, Kingston resembled a ghost town, empty, silent, dark, and broken. 200,000 pounds of damages was assessed, and over 800 people lost their lives. The Gleaner and the Jamaica Daily Telegram published death tolls, which were scanned by thousands searching for news of loved ones. Only a few received proper burial. Some were buried in large trenches in Maypen Cemetery, and some were burnt without ceremony. Fortunately, within the next few months, there was no rain in Kingston, where many people were forced to live in the open air, and the fear of rain would lead to the outbreak of epidemic like typhoid, dysentery, and even the plague was very real. Isn't that something? You see how much similarities there are, you know, with the people having to sleep out in the open in Haiti right now. You know, there are a lot of people who don't even have a tent. But at least, thank God they don't have the fire that happened there. But now I realize that most of these eyewitnesses were either on a ship or, you know, someplace else viewing this, because this particular man. But, you know, we're sort of running out of time. Not really. We do have some more. But, you know, there is another report about an American ship coming to help, and the British, because, you know, it was British owned at the time, were not wanting the Americans to help because of the fear that I suppose they were going to take them over or something like that. But even then, you know, similar situations where there was different arguments and thing about who was helping, who wasn't helping, you know, what was being done right, what should be done a different way. And it just brings me to the point where, you know, a lot of what we see happening now is not really new, you know, and a large part of it is human nature. Wouldn't you agree with that, Leigh?
Yes, well, concurrently, there was a similar situation in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, devastation, just like Jamaica, just like what we're having now in Haiti, and it's a hand of God, so
mm-hmm.
to speak. So, you know, these things have been happening from the beginning of recorded history, and it's still happening now.
And right.
I seem to remember that back in geography class, they would indicate that when it, and one of your reports sort of alluded to what I'm about to say, when it gets extremely hot, unbearably hot, people used to say something is going to happen.
Happen, yes. Uh-huh.
And invariably, as far as Jamaica is concerned, it would be an earthquake or some kind of tremor.
Right.
You know?
But I know last week there was two different people who said they remember tremors before the bigger earthquake, you know?
Yeah.
Not necessarily the same day, but, you know, there were several tremors that I'm sure was not necessarily recorded because there was no damage.
Right.
But I know that I experienced tremors all over the island. I would say I think I remember at least four, beside the big one in 57, which was shortly before I left Jamaica. I left Jamaica in 1959, and I remember that earthquake clearly, really, really clearly. So what I would like for our listeners to just bear in mind, and if they know anyone that, you know, is personally involved with the tragedy, we all have to help in whatever way we can. But one way we can help is to be encouraged and to just believe and know that there is hope. While once there's life, there's always hope. And in spite of how hard it might seem and how bad it may look, I know that better things will come from all of this tragedy, because that's what happened in Kingston. You know, they rebuilt with better materials. The city was laid out in a better manner that would service more people, and you know, things improved. Is my whole point, because how the city was laid out before was totally changed after the earthquake and the fire, because they thought I had a plan. Now, one thing I think that might have been different then than it is in Haiti now is the fact that they had a stable government. And so they had people who could plan and, you know, act on a plan. So that is one big difference. And even in the face of that, I am sure that, you know, things will eventually get better. After all, it can't get much worse.
Well, you know, Haiti has endured, and I'm glad that lady from Canada came on and talked about some of this. I got an email from London alluding to the same treatment that France and especially, but other countries as well, gave to Haiti in the past.
Mm-hmm.
They just took advantage of those people.
Right.
And hopefully this time around, it will be, you know, a much more, to use a broad expression, Christian-like approach to the people. Because they've been treated like slaves from day one and still, you know, and they just give them and take away more.
Right. And that's what I'm bringing out, because some of the reporters and the reports coming out of Haiti, really, not necessarily reporters, might allude to the fact that it's because they're poor and black and poor, of course, while they're behaving the way they are, those that are behaving badly. But it's no such thing. The people in Port Royal were rich and bad, you know, and religious. A lot of them, there were the pirates and the brothels and the churches.
Yeah, if
there weren't any slaves or poor people.
If you recall some of the similar tragedies around the world, whether it be a tsunami, a volcano, an earthquake. People at a certain point get desperate, and it's survival, and looting, quote unquote, looting is going to happen. It doesn't matter what kind of people, what gender people, whatever, it's survival, and they're going to do it.
And not only that, selfishness, as some people would call it, you know, because you got to take care of yourself first.
Yeah.
And if there is shearing, the instinct is going to get more for you and your family. So I'm not saying that it has to be it's understandable, because when people are under the amount of stress that experience can bring, they don't think rationally. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It can drive you crazy, and a lot of people don't behave like a Christian and look out for everybody else when they're just trying to survive, and their brain not working right.
Mm-hmm.
So I was talking to someone and talking about how last week we spoke about someone in Port Royal who shot the other one. To get whatever he had, you know, in cold blood. Both of them survived, but he wanted his stuff, so he killed him. And I'm sure that it might, similar things might be happening where people don't think of the other person because they're taking theirs. You know what I mean? They're looking out for themselves as myself. I'm not saying it's justified. I'm just saying it's understandable because you never know how you're going to act in a situation, you know, until you are in a situation. There are some people who are frozen in fear, and there are some people who take action when they're fearful. But I do want to share some information that came in my email that I think made sense, and some people might have already got the email about it. And Leigh, I think you got it too, so you can help me out on this. And it's finding a safe place in if there's an earthquake, you know, if the earth is shaking, and most people. Unlike a tornado where they tell you to, you know, you have tornado drill here in the south where I live. We have tornadoes, so we know we're told to do certain things if there's a tornado warning in our city and the thing go off. But in an earthquake, and I'm gathering that you could be visiting someplace that is susceptible to earthquakes and have to take cover. And they say that the safest place could be beside a large piece of furniture or as big as you can find and not necessarily under it. Because if the ceiling comes down, you know, there is like a space between where like a plank would fall and the piece of furniture itself. Did you see that email?
No, I didn't see it, but I saw something similar on one of the television stations.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that they were talking about people that were found a week after.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons was that it had these people that they found invariably had an air pocket someplace.
Mm-hmm.
Because the first thing that could make you die very quickly is if the oxygen, the air, is clogged up. You know, so the people that survived for so long was primarily because they had air, number one. And secondly, they had some access to, are in their possession, some water.
Right.
So those
right.
two things you cannot do without.
Right. So what was the directive in terms of if you knew that there was an aircraft, where would you go?
They didn't get to that at all, and that's strange because, you know, it you like to be able to, for instance, tell school children how to behave in situations like this. This I haven't seen anything that does is so instructive. You know, I really haven't. So, what did your
It suggested that you go beside. For instance, I have a cabinet here in my office, and I would go beside it because if you know something would come on top of it and sort of
it would create
a pocket.
Yes,
which made sense to me as I read it.
Yeah.
And, you know, we had a tremor here some years ago in Georgia, and which was very unusual. I mean, it wasn't very severe, but we had one. And with what's going on now, as I mentioned, you never know when you know, that's going to happen. And people are going to be more aware when things like that happen. So I think it would be a good idea to know, not that there's any guarantee, but to know what would be, what precautions could you take at the moment, you know? Just like how, you know, if your clothes catch on fire, you drop and roll, you know, that's the action you take. But I remember one of the things they say, that instead of being in your car, it would be better to be beside the car. You know what I mean?
Really?
Because the car somehow creates something when things fall on it, except if the car going to the ground. That's something different. But right now, I think that we just should be every day, just be very thankful that, you know, we are not experiencing anything, whatever it is that is happening in our lives, cannot in any way compare to what the people right now are experiencing there, what they have experienced and what they continue to experience. So, you know, let us just, in all the things that are happening around us and with our politics and with our economy, we still have so much to be thankful for, just so, so very much. And for us in the diaspora, the people from Jamaica or a Caribbean background, we can just imagine if that was happening in our country, you know, how we would feel. Not being able to get there, not being able to get to our people. And I know there's been a lot of talk about, you know, people are looking out for themselves and the Americans looking out for the Americans, the French people looking for the French. But that's exactly what we would do. If something happened and we know our family or our children is in an area, that's the first thing you're going to do. You're going to check on them. So we can understand some of that happening.
But instead of
dwelling on the negative things that are happening all around us, I think the more energy we give to the positive things is the more that will grow. So I would encourage our listeners that whether it's prayers, it's a kind word, it's a few dollars, it's some donation, it's helping in some way with the people who are trying to raise funds or send things or in whatever way, whether it has to do with something political that you can do, write a letter or engage in some way. I saw where someone in Jamaica, as a matter of fact, they're on Facebook, they're collecting shoes to somehow get to Haiti. And they were having a drive, you know, in their neighborhood for shoes. And I thought, you know, that was really neat. And those of us who have a giving heart, you know, even though things are rough with us, we have so much more than the people there, just like the people, some people all over the world. But, you know, right now we can extend a hand in some way, and if you can, please be sure to do it, because when we do things like that, it's not just for the people, but it's for ourselves, because it really, really, really does something to make you feel better about yourself. So with that said, I want to thank all our listeners for hanging with me. I see everybody on the board is still there, even though they have been quiet, but quiet is good. As long as you're here, I appreciate you. And I would like to ask you to spread the word about the Backyard and get more of your friends to call in or to visit our website, which is www.backyardlabrish.com. Send us a comment. Let us know what you'd like to hear more of when you come gather with us to chill in the backyard. And we'll certainly do it. Because right now, you know, it's your show, not just mine, and I think that's why you're here. So I want to invite you to participate. Now, Leigh, next week I thought we could do a tribute to the professor, and also I understand that an artist, a painter from Jamaica who lived in Baltimore, also passed away. And I'm going to continue to talk about the history. You know, this is History Month. It's Black History Month here and also History Month in Jamaica. And there's always so much about Jamaican history that we never learned in school and that was really never revealed. A lot of it is just coming, you know, becoming public now. Or made public now. I'm sure somebody had it someplace, whether it was letters or information. But again, Dr. Joy Lumsden is doing a marvelous job at just piecing things together, and she has a lot of different historical documents, as in letters and records of events. And incidentally, I want to talk about one more thing. There was a group of Jamaicans. I think there were three women and six men who were, there were a choral group actually, and they were in London performing at the time of the earthquake in 1907. And these were all black Jamaicans. They weren't, you know, foreigners. They were all people who were born and raised in Jamaica. And they were given concerts all over, you know, that area. And they went back shortly after, when they came home, of course, you know, they were well-to-do, it mentioned, you know, they had homes and all of that. A lot of that was destroyed. But the following year when they went back, you know, they were well-supported, mainly because people wanted to contribute and to encourage them. So even in those days in 1907, Jamaican groups were traveling in London and being accepted and revered, really, because they were popular. And I thought that was quite interesting to me. Did you know that? Did we mention this last year?
I'm not sure if I heard it on your blog, but I think so. I think so. I'm aware of groups going, and in particular that one you talked about.
Mm-hmm. And as a matter of fact, Dr. Lumsden even have pictures of them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's quite interesting. And with that, we have 3 minutes to go, and I'd like to ask any of the listeners on the board that just want to give a shout out to anybody or to interact in any way, just hit one on your telephone, and I'll be glad to open up the mic to hear your voice, because that's what this is all about, leaving a living legacy. And we're just honored that Professor Nettleford left us personally here in the backyard with a living legacy of his thoughts. And we will be replaying some of that next week. So with that said, Leigh, thanks for joining us.
Very cold up this way, and we're expecting more bad weather, so stay warm.
Well, down here in the south, I think we're going to be in the 40s tomorrow, and then the next day, and rain, and the next day we're going to be a little cooler. So thank God my house is nice and warm, and I'm staying in. So for the rest of our listeners that are from 301-973-516-404 and all listening online, I want to thank you and tell you how much I appreciate you. The backyard is much warmer when you're here, and I am just enjoying the wonderful breeze. And with a minute to go, I see that 516 want to join the Labrish. So I'm going to open up the mic. And hello, you're on.
Hi, Margaret. This is Janine from
Lanana. Hi, Janine. Welcome to the backyard. We have a few seconds.
Yes, I was a listener tonight. But I just want us to remember the prayer of Francis of Assisi. Lord, grant us the serenity to accept the things we cannot change, courage to change the things we can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen.
Amen. Thank you so much for that.
Very nice, Janine, and good night all.
Good night.
Good night all, and come back next week to the Labrish.
Okay.
And make it a great week, and spread some love. Good night.
Bye.